Good morning. It is 10:05, Wednesday, August 5th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I waited 5 months for hockey to come back just for the Rangers to get swept.
I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I'm not going to say anything more because when you see John Green, he's got some explaining to do.
John Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I'm so glad to see everyone in their new digs.
Yeah, Brian Dean, not a racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine, coming to you live from Louisville, Kentucky. Or Louisville, I don't know how to say it yet, but I'll figure it out.
You'll get there.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder to enter for the industry-leading 2020 Keeneland November breeding stock sale to be held at the home of the Breeders' Cup World Championships now. Learn more at november.keeneland.com. Big weekend for Keeneland grads, pretty much across the board, vexatious in the personal ends end. We're going to get to all these. Improbable in the Whitney, Echo Town, and the H. Allen Jerkins, so swept the grade ones on Saturday at Saratoga. And then Collusion Illusion in the grade one, Bing Crosby, Cross Border, got put up via DQ in the Bowling Green, and then Hopeful Growth in the Monmouth Oaks. So a big weekend for Keeneland grads, and Keeneland November will be here before you know it, pretty much right after the Breeders' Cup. So it'll be an action-packed month down in Lexington. Another huge weekend of racing over at Saratoga and also at Del Mar. But the big story of the weekend to me had to be vexatious, upsetting Midnight Bizou in the personal ensign. We're going to talk to Jack Sisterson a little bit later. It was his first career grade one winner. Just missed getting another one later in the day with Lexingtonian and the Ben Crosby, up and coming trainer for Calumet. Got to think there's some more grade one wins in his future. So a great training job by him. Great ride, I thought, by Jose Lescano, who rode the race basically knowing where Midnight Bizou was at all times. He rode for forward position with a horse who hasn't always shown that much speed, but has developed more speed as time has gone on, really peaking now as a six-year-old mare. No excuse, I thought, for Midnight Bizou. I thought she got a perfect trip, had dead aim at the top of the stretch. I think even got the lead a little bit, maybe past the eighth ball, and just couldn't quite get by. No disgrace for her. I mean, the winner ran a 105 buyer, so really no reason for her to hang her head. You know, it was a great stretch battle, and she's still a great mare. I wonder, Bill was speculating on whether or not she's going to run against the boys in the classic. I think maybe that this kind of puts a little bit of a damper on that. Maybe she'll stick with the girls in the distaff. We're going to hop around a little bit because there was a lot of action to get to, but I also wanted to mention Improbable winning the Whitney. Obviously, the race changed once Tom's d'Etat stumbled coming out of the gate. But I just thought Improbable was so impressive and really came home fast, I believe, in 35 and change. And, you know, I talked about him a little bit last week and what an impressive two-year-old he was, and just really never got going as a three-year-old, had some issues. And it's great to see him fulfill his potential because he does have a massive amount of talent. And now he's got multiple grade one wins. So I think that he has to be considered the leader right now in the older male division. Now, Maximum Security could change that. Tom's d'Etat could come back and change that. But for right now, I got to think he's at the top of the class. And that's something that I would not have predicted a couple months ago, considering the three-year-old year he had. So I'll toss it over to Bill and what stood out for you from this weekend.
Well, I want to talk about, I'm sure we'll get to the shared belief as well with Honor AP, but I'll stick to the races that you talked about. First of all, the personal ensign. One thing you didn't mention, Joe, was there was an inquiry into a stretch bumping incident between the two, between Vexatious and Midnight Bizou. So you could add that to the list of maybe little things that went wrong for Midnight Bizou. But I'm with you. I thought Vexatious deserved the win. I thought she was the best horse in the race. I also think the stewards made the right call not taking Vexatious down in there. And the other thing, too, I always like to go back to the Monomoy Girl Midnight Bizou scenario. It's a little less sexy now if they meet with Midnight Bizou having lost this race. Matter of fact, she has lost three of her last four. Now, that includes the Saudi Cup against the best older males in the world, et cetera. But, you know, keep that in mind when you talk about her. But going back to the Ruffian, Vexatious was clearly second best behind Monomoy Girl, John Green's favorite horse, John Green, who did not explain why he looks like a homeless person this morning when I brought that up in the introductions. But, you know, I know A plus B doesn't always equal C in this sport, but you do have to keep that in mind that, you know, that makes Monomoy Girl's comeback look even stronger. So now going to the other race that you mentioned, the Whitney. Yeah, Improbable is obviously really good, but I think that we have to give Tom Stettot a pass on that. You know, he came out of the gate very slowly, lost about 4 or 5 lengths at the start, and really against that level of competition, he wasn't going to win that race when he didn't get out of the gate. So I guess on paper, Improbable might be number one right now, but I'm not convinced that Tom Stettot's not still the best older male in the country.
Yeah, and Bill, just to jump on your bandwagon with the, talking about the Whitney, you know, it wasn't just Tom Stettot who had a bad start, and he had a bad start, but also By My Standards broke awkwardly and kind of a step behind. So it was really a weird race where 40% of the horses in the race had, you know, questionable breaks from the gate. But Improbable certainly looked like the best horse that day against a small field, but a really solid field, you know, from top to bottom. One of the races I wanted to talk about actually was the Jerkins presented by Run Happy, which was also a grade one at Saratoga, 7 furlong sprint, where top to bottom 11 horses, you know, really were some solid sprinters in there. And there were multiple grade one winners already in the race. Echo Town really looked the part, came from off it. And for a Spitestown to sit off the pace is a little bit unusual, but certainly he ran a really big race. One of the other reasons why I wanted to mention this race in particular is we don't talk a lot about the breeders that often, but I personally know Bill Betts, who's one of the co-breeders of Echo Town. And Bill has a really nice small boutique farm in Kentucky, right in the heart of breeding, you know, of the breeding territory. And just over the past couple of years, Bill's horses have listed, you know, like the who's who in racing. He's only got like a dozen mares, but he's already bred Echo Town, who won a grade one, Opportunity, who won a grade one, J-Boy's Echo, multiple graded stake winner, a horse called Mind That Bird, who won the 2009 Kentucky Derby, Madcap Escapade, Dubai Escapade, and the list kind of goes on and on. So in an industry where, you know, we talk a lot about the larger breeders, it was really nice to see somebody like Bill and his partners tally up another grade one winner. And it was a sixth graded winner as a breeder in the past 3 years. And that's really an accomplishment. So kudos to that organization. Echo Town looked the best. Tap It to Win, I thought, put in a very credible race also after, you know, the speed, you know, kind of beat each other up with No Parole and Mischievous Alex. They kind of went head to head and softened it up for everybody else. But that was a really impressive race. The Jerkins, the you know, sponsored by Run Happy, you know, up at Saratoga. I was impressed watching that race myself.
Sticking with three-year-old sprinters, I don't know why he hasn't really gotten much press, but I think Collusion Illusion is a very nice horse. He won the Bing Crosby against Older Saturday at Del Mar. He's 5-for-6 lifetime, perfect 3-for-3 this year. I know he got a pace set up. He didn't run a particularly fast race, but I think he's pretty nice. I think he might actually be the best three-year-old sprinter in America. And it made complete sense to stay there and not go to Saratoga. I mean, they got their grade one and everything, but I think he's an interesting horse. I don't know if it'll matter when we get, you know, when this group of three-year-old sprinters goes on and takes on, you know, Volatile and those kind of horses. It might not matter. They're not running fast enough at this point, but I think he's sneaky. I actually think the horse who won last weekend, the Smiling Tiger at Del Mar, Vertical Threat, I think he might actually be kind of on par with those Jerkins horses as well. So there are a couple, you know, California sprinters are always dangerous. I think those are two to watch for, you know, heading towards the Breeders' Cup.
So Bill alluded to the Shared Belief Stakes, and that was a result that I didn't really see coming. I think a lot of people didn't. Honor AP was obviously a prohibitive favorite. 1,000 Words winning at about 9-1 and getting a 104 buyer, which was, it's a pretty standout number for this class so far. And, you know, if you guys want to throw up the graphic, we've got now a tightening race in the three-year-old Derby Chase standings here on the writer's room. Al is making a late push. He's up to 208 now with the win from 1,000 Words. He said himself that he doesn't want 1,000 Words in the Derby, but you know, he's done the job for him so far. He's got him 120 points in two races as the supplemental pick, which Brian's such a big fan of. So he's only 57 points off the lead now. Obviously, we had the Travers this weekend. I kind of want to segue into that. That's the big meat centerpiece, of course, at Saratoga. Tis the Law is going to be a prohibitive favorite. We also have the Test and the Ballerina this weekend at Saratoga, but just looking at some of the potential matchups for Tis the Law, got Country Grammar, who won the Peter Pan for Chad Brown, Uncle Chuck, Max Player. Those couple of the big contenders, but you've got Chivery and Caracaro in there as well. So, you know, not an all-star field, but enough to give some kind of pause before taking a super short price on Tislelaw. It'd also be his first time going a mile and a quarter. It'd be a nice little dry run for a lot of horses going into the Derby a month later. The test, we might have Gamine running over the weekend at Saratoga shipping in. But, you know, it's just – this is a major turning point, I think, for the three-year-olds going into the Derby. And we also have the Ellis Park Derby this weekend. Thankfully, our collector is going to run and hopefully pick up some more points for me. But this is like the last dress rehearsal, I feel like, for the Derby. And then after this weekend, I think we'll have the field set, and we'll have 4 weeks to, you know, finally, you know, actually dive into the actual field for the Derby. We've kind of been speculating for months on end now. But, you know, big test for Tislelaw. You got to think he's going to be 3-5, 4-5. But I don't think it's exactly a walkover this weekend for him. What do you guys think?
Well, let's go backwards, because I did want to talk about the shared belief in Honor AP. I thought T.D. Thornton used a couple words that really summed up very adequately or accurately how Honor AP ran. He called the performance flat and unmotivated. And I think that really does sum it up. I know he got knocked around a little bit at the start. The horse had absolutely no excuse. And the race was not so much about who won, but who lost. And, you know, was perhaps this a race where he you know, wasn't that tight because the Derby's coming up. John Sheriff's, you know, might have had that going into it. Maybe that had been his philosophy. But I don't think you can look at that race and say anything too positive about it. And, you know, this is a horse that was really being put up as the main threat to Tislelaw in the Kentucky Derby, the main horse out of California, the main horse that Tislelaw had not faced before. Now he's going to come into the Derby off of a performance that, again, was flat and unmotivated. I can't think the camp really that got what they wanted out of the race. And I got to think now you do have to downgrade Honor AP's chances in the Kentucky Derby off a pretty uninspiring last prep before the race.
And I'm going to flip back to the Run Happy Traverse, the other grade one coming up this weekend that we're talking about, a mile and a quarter. To me, it really is a Tislelaw and kind of everyone else again, and that's not a surprise. But you look at some of these horses in this race, and there's potentially a maiden running in the race. There's a horse that's running long for the first time. There's a horse that's running, you know, the first time two turns. And then there's a couple of horses that kind of place in the Peter Pan. But overall, when you talk about the Run Happy Traverse, the grade one, and the essence of what it means to breeders, I don't think they anticipated this being the group of horses that we're going to run in here. So I'm a little disappointed personally that there aren't other three-year-olds that are kind of taking up the challenge and running in this kind of a race.
But well, who else would you want to see?
You know, well, there's a whole host of them. I mean, you can start with, you know, with Art Collector and some of the other ones that we're talking about that are running this weekend in the Ellis Park Derby. And I understand why. I understand that they're trying to get the easier path to the Derby. But as a fan of racing, I would have loved to have seen some of the other bigger heads run in this race and try to, you know, go from the Traverse to the Derby. And again, I know it's a weird year, and nobody was thinking in January about using the Traverse as the springboard for the Kentucky Derby. But for a $750,000 race of this caliber, I would have liked to have seen a little bit better group, you know, going into it. But Joe, you're right. Could I name them off the top of my head? I mean, I'm sure we can sit down and the four of us could think of three or four other horses that could be in this race that would make it a deeper pool for sure.
Hey, Joe, I want to jump in real quick because I want to say again to John, I disagree with you. I mean, you got the best horse in the country, clearly in Tislelaw. You got Uncle Chuck, who's a really interesting up-and-comer. And in this day and age, when horses run 5-6 times a year and have to have 2 months off in between starts, you really don't do much better than this. I mean, this is a testament to modern racing in 2020. I think you're being a little unfair to the Run Happy Travers. I really do. I mean, Tislelaw all by himself makes it a race that you have to watch and have to pay attention to. And again, you know, I think Joe made a good point. Who else do you want? You can come up with Art Collector, and other than that, really, you know, you can't. So, you know, is it the best Travers ever? No, but I think you're being a little bit unfair myself.
Well, even if I understand what you're saying, and I did say, you know, it's Tislelaw and kind of everybody else. But, you know, you can even look at some of the horses that maybe ran in the Jerkins and say, okay, maybe Tap It to Win could have run in the Traverse if they want to try him a mile and a quarter. It's a stretch. I mean, I'm kind of doing this off the top of my head, but I would just have liked to have seen, and this is going to fall into one of the things we're talking about later on with the 2 year olds, but I'll jump into it now. Is, you know, some of these ratings for graded stake races are way overinflated. And, you know, when we look back at this Traverse versus other Traverses, I think that you're going to say that Tis the Law won it and it was great. And that's what's going to, you know, the reason why it's going to be able to keep its grade one status, no question about it. But when you look at maybe the second or third place horses, a year from now, you're not even going to remember really who they were. And, you know, you look at some of the 2 year old races that are coming up out in California, there's two grade two races out there. And I will, you know, basically guarantee you that we're not going to hear from 95% of them after this fall. I mean, they're just, it's kind of silly that they're even still grade twos out there for 2 year olds that are up to the same level. A grade two is a grade two is a grade two. So is, you know, are the races out in California as good as the Bluegrass or as good as some of the other Derby preps that, you know, the Gulfstream Oaks, the Gulfstream Derby that we're talking about? I don't really think that they are. So I think that's kind of blending into my thinking a little bit, guys, is that, you know, is this race legitimately of a grade one caliber talent?
John Green boldly coming out for downgrading the Traverse.
In the weirdest year ever. Come on.
I know. It is weird. I know. I get it.
It was relegated to being a prep. You know what I mean? Like, that's basically all there is to it. Like, if this were, you know, in its normal position on the calendar months after the Derby, I think you would have a stronger field. I think that has a lot to do with it. But I'm going to toss it to Brian now since we've been interrupting him for 5 minutes.
Okay, where do I start? I don't know. We keep jumping back and forth. I'm going to agree with Bill on the Travers. I think it's a decent little field. I mean, Uncle Chuck obviously could still be any kind. I think Country Grammar is a legitimate, you know, graded stakes kind of horse. Obviously, he won a graded stake last time. Max Player, I think, still has a lot of upside. So I think it's a solid little field. And we have First Line, the horse that Orlando Note has been touting for a very long time and calling him his Derby horse. So it'll be interesting. He did run a pretty big number last time, so it'll be interesting to see if he, you know,
as the owner of Honoré, what did you think of his performance?
I think Bill is so wrong about his take on this race that it's incredible. Wow. I was trying to jump in. I don't know how you could not, like, how you could think that was a – I mean, he, like, the other thing that TD called it was a trap race, which is exactly what it was. He gets, you know, slammed out of the gate. A Baffert horse gets completely loose on the lead in a four-horse field. Of course he's not going to run – he's not going to blow by him, especially at a mile and 16th when he's a true, you know, mile and eighth and up horse. He's still paired up 102 buyers. I think he looks great on paper to me for the Derby. I don't know if he's as good as Tis the Law, but he looks like I think he's going to run a huge race. And I think it's kind of a perfect setup for him. And, you know, those short fields, weird things always happen in short fields. And it's something I've kind of realized when we started, you know, when I started owning horses, you always get excited when you get some scratches and the field gets kind of short and you think, okay, this is a good opportunity. And something always weird happens. Some, you know, I don't know what it is, but you never, you know, no horse like this, he just didn't get his pace. And, you know, it was a prep. I'm sure he wasn't fully cranked. And I think he's perfectly set up for the Derby.
Bill, care to counter that?
Well, I mean, he's a good horse, but he's no Harvey's Little Ghoul. We know that.
I mean,
what can I say? I already made my case. That's what makes this game so interesting. I think at 1-5, you're supposed to win this race no matter what happens. So, but we'll find out a couple weeks from now at Churchill Downs. And, we'll see. I can't see him winning the Kentucky Derby off this, but save this clip and play it back on the first show after the Kentucky Derby and we'll find out.
In sticking with looking forward to this weekend, not just the 3 year olds that'll be on the stage, it'll also be the 2 year olds as we're going to start having, you know, graded stakes for 2 year olds. We already had the Stylerville on opening day at Saratoga, but now we're really going to get into the meat of the 2 year old season, stake season. Saratoga specials on Friday. We got the Best Pal and the Sorrento also this weekend at Del Mar. Some pretty interesting fields. I mean, it's tough to say exactly. We don't have the draw yet, but Saratoga special looks like it might get a pretty good field with Casadero, who won the Bashford Manor so impressively, and Momos, who we talked to Christoph Clement about, is a TDN rising star. Roderick, really impressive horse for Wesley Ward. Not sure yet if he's going to run in the Saratoga special or the Best Pal. But otherwise, you know, it's exciting to see the two-year-olds start to come to hand. You know, earlier in the year, that was one of the things that was really missing when we got shut down because of the virus was that we didn't really have as much two-year-old racing as we normally would. Obviously, Keeneland going down in April was a big factor in that. But I just kind of wanted to open it up. Brian had a couple of thoughts on the two-year-old so far. I wanted to open it up to you guys. One horse that I wanted to mention who I made a rising star, so I always you always have a little connection to those horses. It's a horse named Toby's Heart, and she's a filly, and she's a turf sprinter thus far, at least, by Jack Milton. She has the second highest buyer for a two-year-old so far this year. She got an 86. And if you want to see a really, really impressive two-year-old race, go watch her debut at Churchill Downs. She got left at the start. She got checked in between horses early on. She made this huge sustained move on the turn, had to steady again at the top of the stretch, and then still blew away her competition, won by like 7 lengths. She's been working on the dirt. She's a Brian Lynch trainee. Jack Milton, you would think of as more of a turf sire, but she's been working on the dirt on Monday at Churchill Downs. She had a half mile breeze, best of 123 at the distance and 47-3. So I don't see her in any of the probables for any of these races thus far, but she's one that I would definitely be super excited about, especially if she's able to take to the dirt. But I'm going to toss it over to Brian now because I know he pays super close attention to the two-year-olds.
Yeah, like you said, that Saratoga special, and the PPs are drawn. It's a crazy tough field. There's also that Rising Star, the Ride of a Lifetime, the Candy Ride that from, I think he won a Keeneland second out. He's in there. The horse that beat him is in there. Obviously, Cosadero has great form. Momos, really nice horse. There's a horse that's 2 for 2 from coming from Gulfstream, who I think is pretty good as well. So it's definitely a really nice field. The two California baby races this weekend, not quite as strong, especially the Philly race. I'm looking forward to Ambivalent in the Colt race. Still a maiden, very expensive constitution. I think it was the most expensive constitution two-year-old in training this year, and I think they think pretty highly of him. Looking back at this past weekend, I think the Chad Brown horse, reinvestment risk, the upstart was maybe the most impressive two-year-old we've seen thus far. That race was loaded. There were a lot of horses getting touted before the race, and I mean, he's had a good trip, but he just totally dusted them. And I felt good about it because I've been touting Upstart as I think I've told people it was the next constitution, and it hasn't quite worked out yet. But I think some of his better ones are still, we're still in the barn, at least until this weekend. I think he's got a couple other nice ones. And Chad and Mike Ryan bought another one for like 600, I think, at that same sale that's in training now. And it'll be interesting to see if he runs like his stablemate. And there was one other horse I thought was worth checking out over the weekend. Belafonte, Tonalus Colt, won first out at Ellis on Sunday. Went off at 49-1 for an owner trainer. Totally blew the break. Made this huge sweeping move to kind of, you know, loop past the field. Galloped out great. We actually called and tried to make an offer on him, and it was already up to a really, really crazy price. So I think, he's – a lot of people saw it and liked it, and he'll be an interesting horse. I think he's kind of a true, I don't want to call him a derby horse off a race in August, but I think he seems like that kind of horse for next year.
How long was the race?
7 furlongs.
7? All right.
Yeah, and he's bred to go, you know.
I was going to say if it was like 5.5 and it was Tonalist, that's even more impressive because yeah. I don't think of him as a sprint sire.
Right. Yeah.
John?
No, I was going to say that was an impressive race. You know, anytime you get a two-year-old to run first time out and with 7/8, it's always tough. And they did it not only, 7/8, not only in the mud, but also giving the field, a good 5 lengths and then going between horses and making a big run. And they're also training him at a training center, which is always tough, to try to switch surfaces, on top of all that. So they were asking a lot of Belafonte, and he ran a pretty impressive race. Brian, going back to what you were saying about the baby race on August 1st at Saratoga, there were 9 horses in there, and I can honestly tell you that I got touted on 6 of the 9 horses in there. I mean, it was billed as the toughest baby race of the year, and investment risk really just put them all away. An upstart colt that you mentioned, that Chad Brown trains for Klarovich Stable, that was really, really impressive. Joe, just to piggyback on something you said before, at least on Twitter, they're saying that Roderick is going to go to the Best Pal. And I think that makes the most sense. Even though it's tough to go cross country, it is a much, much easier race than what the Saratoga Special is laying out to be. The Saratoga Special is a really salty, solid grade 2, and legitimately so. The Best Pal is a grade 2 also. Again, you wonder about that. And it's interesting about any time that somebody manages a stable, impressively, I always take note of it. and the Sorrento has, you know, eight horses, seven horses in it, and James Chapman is shipping in three horses in there. And you know what? You know, considering there's a maiden in there, there's a horse that broke its maiden for maiden 50, two horses that broke their maidens for maiden 50, and then Chapman's three horses that cost 6,000, 3,000, and 5,000 respectively. You got to tip your hat to them, because one of those horses is probably, if not more, is probably going to hit the board. And all of a sudden, those fillies are going to be worth a hell of a lot more with a G2 next to their name than they are, you know, running in an allowance race somewhere. So, you know, I give him a lot of credit for actually shipping in three horses into the Sorrento, as it's a grade two this year.
Couple thoughts on this. You know, the conversation of the two-year-olds is going to change a lot between now and the Breeders' Cup. And one of the reasons why is Baffert ran his first two-year-old of the year this weekend at Del Mar. It's a horse by the name of Freedom Fighter that did win. Didn't look like it was going to be one of Baffert's real superstars, a horse by Violence. So, you know, what we're talking about in early August and what's going to be the story come November is probably going to change quite a lot. And I just want to add my two cents to this horse reinvestment risk. Everybody's talking about how many horses are being touted in this. The Daily Racing Form Clocker Report, which does a really good job, was just raving again about six or seven horses in there. So you figure if somebody's going to win this race, it's going to be, you know, competitive, going to win by half length, something like this. Horse won by 7 3/4 lengths. And, you know, obviously Chad Brown is not somebody, you know, of a Wesley Ward ilk that is going to have these things hooked up and ready to go 4.5 furlongs. And, you know, you just think they're precocious horses you aren't going to hear from anymore. So reinvestment risk, I think right now is a very exciting prospect.
Yeah, and you got a 90 buyer, which is the fastest of any two-year-old so far this year. Just looking at the top two-year-old buyers, it's kind of interesting. For me, I think this is a little bit of an abnormality. Already 11 two-year-olds have run 80-plus buyers. I feel like that's kind of high for this time of year. What we spoke about, a handful of them are going to run this weekend. The Ride of a Lifetime that Brian mentioned got an 85 in his Keeneland win. He's a rising star as well. Jackie's Warrior, who's also going to be in the Saratoga Special, got an 81. We talked about Casadero as well, but seems like a pretty early crop of two-year-olds so far. Maybe there hasn't been that, you know, kind of, you know, breakaway star just yet, but it seems like there's a good amount of really solid two-year-olds and a lot of horses to be excited about, especially as we get, you know, through this weekend's Grade Stakes and towards the Run Happy Hopeful and the Run Happy Del Mar Futurity. Really exciting. Sets up for a really exciting fall with the two-year-olds, and we're glad that, you know, we can see the babies run again, because, you know, it ain't racing in the spring and summer without two-year-olds. So good stuff from reinvestment risk, and a lot of other horses to be excited about potentially out of that race. You never know. You know, just because he won by a lot doesn't mean there aren't any stars behind him as well. So owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Hard Not to Love or Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So some action this weekend in the three-year-old race for West Point. Dallas Stewart's trainee, Winning Impression. He's currently 24th on the Kentucky Derby points leaderboard, but he's going to run in the Run Happy Ellis Park Derby this Sunday to try to punch his ticket into the Derby. So not too far out of the picture, and we'll have to upset our collector, but definitely has a fighting chance. Facing Tipton Horses of Racing, a Sail Topper County Final, is going to make his first start for his new trainer, Steve Asmussen, this weekend in the Tyro Stakes at Monmouth in the TDN's backyard. And Decorated Invader, as I mentioned in the open, on track for the $500,000 Saratoga Derby Invitational. Little known the fact that John Green won that race last year. I don't think anybody's ever mentioned that on this show. But so best of luck to them. And, you know, action across the board, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, older horses. But obviously the three-year-olds are going to take center stage here in the next couple of weeks for West Point. So best of luck to all the guys and girls over at West Point. And we hope to see you in the Derby. All right, so this was proposed and rumored in the previous weeks. Now it seems that it's official that jockeys are going to have to quarantine for a couple weeks before riding at Churchill Downs for the Derby meet. It was reported that any jockey expecting to ride in the Kentucky Derby on September 5th or Kentucky Oaks on September 4th must arrive in Kentucky by August 24th, according to Churchill Downs' proposed regulations. Track president Kevin Flannery said the rule is still under consideration, but it seems like it's pretty much in stone. Says all riders, not just those chipping in from out of state, must pass two separate coronavirus tests, one by 6 p.m. on Monday, August 24th, and then a second by noon on Monday, August 31st. Jockeys testing positive will be required to quarantine for 10 days. Seems like they're doing a lot of good things now. They're going to have an auxiliary jockey room to try to separate and create more social distancing. So want to give a shout out and a hat tip to Churchill Downs for doing that. I think overall, this is probably the right, you know, responsible call to separate the jockeys after what we saw earlier in the summer with, you know, riders jumping all across the country and getting infected. But to me, you know, we've been through this before, but to me, it's not congruent to me to have these kind of strict rules for the jockeys, which I don't think are unreasonable, but then to also still have a plan going forward to have tens of thousands of fans through the gates for the Kentucky Derby. And then we still don't know exactly how many fans they're planning to have, but we also don't have a very strong, you know, mandated COVID screening or mandated mask wearing for the fans that will potentially be at Churchill Downs for the Derby. So it doesn't square to me to have these kind of strict rules for the jockeys. Jockeys, if they want to ride in the Derby, are going to have to give up, you know, 10 days, almost 2 weeks of mounts and income at Saratoga and Del Mar to run in the Derby. I mean, that's a tough ask for some of these guys, I think. And especially guys like Manny Franco, who, you know, this is kind of the ride of a lifetime, and you're forcing his hand there to where he can't ride at Saratoga for the last couple of weeks. So, you know, it makes sense. You know, I don't totally disagree with it, but we need more clarification on what's going on with the fans, what's going on with the plan for spectators at the Derby, because it doesn't seem to match up to have these kind of strict rules and then still just let people flood in the gates with no mask mandate, no COVID test, no negative COVID test necessary. So I'll toss it over to Bill. What do you think about these rules?
I couldn't agree with you more. I do think they're doing the right thing by the jockeys, and anybody is saying, well, how can you do that and still let the fans in? Well, two wrongs don't make a right. So let's do each one separately. They're doing the right thing by the jockeys because, you know, we found out what happens when these guys start shipping all over the country. And look, people's health and safety is more important than a horse race. Now, before I say too much more, we're doing this Wednesday morning, and Churchill is supposed to have more announcements coming out, maybe even as soon as today, about several things, including what they're going to do with the fans. But I mean, this sounds harsh, but if it were up to me, I got to say that you can't have fans at the Derby. I mean, how can you? You know, maybe you can have the owners come in, something like that. But, you know, you can't, I agree with 100%. You can't say John Velasquez in New York, a jockey, can't come to the Kentucky Derby, but Joe Racing fan from Brooklyn can come to the Kentucky Derby. How does that make it? I didn't even do that on purpose, but hey, Joe Racing fan from Brooklyn.
How'd you know I had tickets?
Yeah, right. But it just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen so far as what they're going to do about the attendance. You know, the governor obviously is going to have some say on this. But so far as we know, all we've heard is that they can have fans at the Kentucky Derby. They've never said how many are going to be in there. And, you know, things even like they said, well, we're not going to require people to wear masks. I think that's going to change. I don't know what the heck is going to happen, but it doesn't look good. Our favorite word, optics. How can you let all these people come in? And, you know, personally, I wouldn't go. I wouldn't feel safe. And there's going to be a lot of people are going to feel the same way. So we'll see what happens. I don't think the final story has been written on this yet.
Yeah. And this is the first year I can honestly say in the 30 plus that we've been in the business where I can put my head on the pillow and say, wow, I'm really glad we don't have a Derby or Oaks contender this year, because I don't know how I would personally handle that dilemma. Because the reason why you're in this business as an owner is to get to that holy grail, to get to Churchill Downs for the Derby Oaks weekend. And if you're unable to go, or you're more importantly unsure about your health risk of going, is it worth it to watch your horse run in that race? And then, you know, all the things you guys said, I agree with as far as the jockeys and how it's important for their own health. To make them go through that protocol. They're actually, depending on what state they're coming in from, not only are they going to have the quarantine incoming, but they may have the quarantine outgoing when they go back home, depending on the state and what their current protocols and quarantine rules are. So some of these jockeys may be giving up almost an entire month's worth of income to ride that weekend down at Churchill Downs. Now, again, for Manny Franco, it makes sense because he's got such a great chance to not only win the Derby, but I'll guarantee he's going to pick up one of the favorites for the Oaks also because he's going to be one of the name brand jockeys that's going to be there. I also wonder aloud how this is going to spill over into the sales that are coming up the very following week after the Derby. You have Fasig that has its two-day sale, and then Keeneland has their big, massive yearling sale coming up. And what is that going to mean to people who are attending? What's the protocol going to be? Are they going to have to wear masks out, even though they're outside the whole time? There's going to be potentially international buyers there, maybe. So it's really still unknown what's going to happen and unwritten as far as what the rules are going to be. But I would also be concerned about health and safety, you know, for those sales that are immediately following the Oaks and Derby.
Yeah, and on the sale front, I think Keelan came out last week and said that you'll be required to show a negative COVID test to attend the sales, which will be interesting. And obviously will, you know, limit attendance to a degree. I think it's important to note that Churchill is going to operate. They're better off operating as if they're going to have fans and maybe like the week before having to change their mind. You know, nothing official is set in stone. I think the governor came out, I think it was yesterday during his press conference, and said basically he hadn't made any decisions yet. He wanted to hear the proposal from Churchill. So, you know, from Churchill's perspective, they can, I think it makes more sense to operate this way, act as if you're going to have fans. And, you know, if there's a spike in the next month, you can always pull back and not allow fans. You're better off doing that than not at least preparing for that option. And it's kind of like everything in this current, you know, era that we're living in that, no one really knows anything. It's kind of a last minute decision or just, you know, so I guess we'll see what happens. And obviously it'll be interesting to see which jockeys decide to forego Saratoga. It didn't really dawn on me when the scheduling kind of came out that Saratoga and the Derby will be running on the same day, which will be particularly kind of weird and surreal. But it'll be interesting to see which of those New York guys decide to head to Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting wrinkle, but they're putting a lot of people, a lot of tough spots. I don't blame them for that. But again, like, it doesn't jive with what's going on with the plan for fans. I don't know that you can wait until a week before the Derby. I think logistically, like, a lot of people got to make plans a little bit further out in advance than that. But I pulled up the COVID case stats for Kentucky, and today they reported 689 new cases, which is the fourth highest number of new cases that they've had in a day so far since the whole thing started. And all four of the biggest increases have happened in the last two and a half weeks. So it seems like they, you know, while it seemed like they had it under control for a while, much like the rest of America, it's rising again. They've had 33,209 total cases, 769 deaths, and of those cases, 7,414 have been in Jefferson County, where Churchill Downs is located. So it doesn't—I don't know—it doesn't seem like Kentucky is in as good of a shape as New York, New Jersey, some of the states in the Northeast. Obviously, things can change. We still have, you know, over about a month, actually a month exactly, to the Derby, and things can change. But I don't know, the way it's going, it doesn't seem. Likely that we're going to have fans in the stands for the Derby. And I think that would be the prudent decision to make. And Bill has said this before, but like, there really haven't been big crowds anywhere in America. I think NASCAR has had some fans. Monmouth has had some fans, but overall we haven't had a big event like this where everybody's watching and there's tens of thousands of people in the stands. Cause I think, you know, organizers and sports are very careful not to be the first ones out into the wilderness in that way. And then have the embarrassment and the shame of maybe having a related COVID spike because you decided to have fans at your event. So just seems inexorably we're heading towards Churchill saying no fans, but you know, I guess they are going to wait as long as they can and wait for guidance from the governor, but that seems to be the way it's going. But I just, you know, in terms of the jockeys, I think they are doing the right thing. So I gotta give them credit for that.
Yeah. Brian, you're down there now. You're physically living.
Joe's making me feel like an idiot for moving from New Jersey to Jefferson County. I'm like looking out the window. I will say that I think mask wearing there's definitely a slightly lower percentage of mask wearing here compared to New Jersey. Right. You know, that's kind of anecdotal, but
when you're going to Ellis Park or you're going to the tracks in the morning, like what's the protocol to get in?
To get in, in the morning, there's like a little tent, you go up, they scan your license, you know, your owner's license or whatever, you know, your trainer's license. And they take your temperature and give you a wristband, and pretty much what they did at Phasig, at the Mid-Atlantic sale, kind of the same thing. You know, it's something. I mean, obviously you're not getting a test or anything, but it's some kind of screening. I wouldn't say mask wearing has been perfect on the backside, but it's been okay. And I think people are at least, seems like people are kind of keeping their distance a little bit, you know, on the rail, that kind of thing.
With COVID testing, like the delays in testing,
right.
That's a big problem in America. Yeah. Still somehow 6 months into this that, right. You know, you can't necessarily get a test back in 24, 48 hours unless you're in the NBA or something. So
right. That's
a big problem too, that even, I think that's why it's smart that Churchill is requiring two negative tests before they let the jockeys ride, because, you know, with the delay, you never know whether you're going to get accurate information that's accurate a week later, you know. Right. But Bill, sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no problem. There's just another factor here that we haven't brought up. Now, this isn't all up to horse racing. In New York right now, there's many states where if you leave the state and go to that state, you have to quarantine for 14 days when you come back to New York. And Kentucky is on that list. So I would imagine that would involve, you know, fans, jockeys, and then also the sales as well. I imagine if, you know, an owner from New York, I don't see why it would be any different, there'd be any exceptions, would go to the sales or go to the Derby or whatnot, then they're sidelined for 14 days when they come back to New York as well. So, you know, this is very complicated, and it's not entirely up to horse racing, but, you know, that's another factor there. And John mentioned it, you know, you talk about the Manny Francos of the world. Not only are they going to miss the last weekend of Saratoga and or Del Mar, but, you know, what is the procedure? They'll miss the first 2 weeks of September as well when they come back. So you're basically asking a guy to give up a month of riding to ride in these big races at Churchill Downs. You know, and it's, for some, it's an easy call. For some, it's a very difficult call. So we'll just have to see what happens. And the only one we know so far is Manny Franco, agent Angel Cordero, has said, yes, we're going to go. This is the horse of a lifetime. How could we not? And, you know, that's the answer I think we all expected from him.
Yeah, and what's to stop these guys, at least from New York, going to Kentucky and just staying in Kentucky and basically finishing out the Churchill meet and then going and you're rolling into the Kentucky Downs and then the Keeneland meet. I mean, there's still a lot of money to be made, but you're giving up all of your mounts and basically living at home up here in New York.
But John, that's a good point, because remember, we may have to go through all this all over again for the Breeders' Cup.
Right.
And, you know, the exact same thing, 14 days out, can't ride till 14 days later. Now, the Breeders' Cup, as attractive as the Derby is, the Breeders' Cup is even more attractive because it's so many more races. So I think a lot of guys would make that decision. So that's another possibility. These guys could go down, ride at Churchill, and not come back to New York until after the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, and the purses are great down here, and they came out yesterday, and the Churchill condition book is out now, and purses are solid. So it makes a lot of sense.
And the jockey colony is just meh right now, I think.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah.
But I get used to them. Those are going to be like 18 out of the 20 riders in the Derby, so you better learn some of those names. I'm sure Brian already knows them all. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the man of the hour, trainer of new Grade 1 winner Vexatious, and almost had another Grade 1 win on Saturday, Jack Sisterson. Jack, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure.
Of course. So I said on Saturday that this is probably not going to be your last Grade 1 win. You're an up-and-coming young guy. But before we get to all that and your history, I want to ask about Vexatious, because she's an interesting horse. You know, she's kind of at her peak now as a six-year-old. You don't often see that. She started, you know, I think she really kind of broke through with that second to Monomoy Girl, and then obviously beating a champion like Midnight Bizou over the weekend was just an incredible accomplishment. What have you seen from her that has helped her kind of break through at this late stage in her career?
You know what, Joe? She came in from Neil in great shape, and thanks to Neil, we didn't have to do much with her. She acted like she was very forward filly and loves to train and race. And thankfully she's sound, and she does, as a public soul, she blossoms it in Saratoga. And I didn't have to do anything, Joe. She deserves all the credit there, that we sort of, initially we wanted, because of how well she ran in the summer colony last year at Saratoga, we wanted to sort of focus this year on her potentially peaking mid-summer and leading into the summer fall and things like that. So as of now, the sort of the plan's working out quite well. And she acts like a horse that's going to continue to progress. I know she's 6 years old now. You think, well, surely not a six-year-old, but she came out the race in great shape, and we'll continue to move forward, and I think she'll continue to improve.
Hey, Jack, it's Bill Finley. Thanks for joining us. I want to get away from the horses for a minute and find out a little bit more about your main owner, Calumet Farm, where you've had all this success for. And Brad Kelly, the owner, is publicity shy, so we don't know a whole lot about him. Anything you could tell us to shed some light on what kind of guy he is, what his goals are in racing, what motivates him at the end of the day, et cetera?
Yeah, Mr. Kelly's so passionate about the sport. It was touching to me on Saturday, just hearing him so excited after the Vexatious, and even when Everfast won, just competing in obviously the grade one type of races is his goal. Obviously having a big breeding operation, you want sort of a broodmare like Vexatious in that broodmare band, and the goal going into it was potentially trying to get lucky to hit the board and never mind win it. So it was a very exciting time for him, and not only for him, but for Calumet as well. There's so much history behind Calumet itself, and trying to get Calumet to back to where it was. Fingers crossed the result on Saturday is a stepping stone for bigger and better things for Calumet.
And Jack, it's John Green. And one of the joys that I've had over the years in the business is every time we fly into Bluegrass Airport, you fly right over the farm and you see the whiter than white fences and the beautiful barns and the beautiful paddocks. And for a number of years, Calumet was the measuring stick that all of us would try to, aspire to. Ranging from all the years of all the great horses they've had to when we first got into the business, when Alidar and Affirmed were both standing stud there. When you were touched to be the trainer, for Calumet, it must have been just a great experience for you. Walk us through when they first gave you the call and said, you know what, you're going to bring us back to the promised land. And, rightfully so, now Calumet is the leading owner in monies earned in the United States. What goes through your mind when they call and they tout you to be the primary trainer for them?
Initially when, I had a small conversation with them and chatting back and forth. I'd never been to the farm before, and obviously everyone knows I was working for Doug at the time, and Doug still to this day is very supportive of everything that I do, and I'm very grateful for it. And it was Doug that pushed me out to, if you don't do it, I'm going to do it. So I like you said, you're flying into the airport there, and my just small little glimpse of Calumet was a bird's eye view, and that was for a couple of seconds. And so you hang up the phone, and been from England and a soccer player, when you grow up there's a Manchester United, and they are top of the league the whole time, and so much history and success they have. So you sort of go back in time. I assume Calumet was the Manchester United of the Premier League. So for me, I didn't know too much about Calumet, and I still don't, but I'm learning. And so I sort of Googled it, and just the success, it was, I don't know the correct words to how to describe, wow. Why would they want someone like me? I'm nobody there. It was honoring, humbling, and I'm just a very, very, very small piece of so much hard work that goes in behind the scenes that people don't see. And, it's unfortunate it read my name in the program on Saturday, but there's so many more people that worked harder than I did to allow Vexatious to compete there at that grade one level. And But going back to being approached by Canada, it was humbling, and you sort of, you want to represent them well, so you want to do what's right by Calumet, and so you figure out things of what should I do, what shouldn't I do, and things like that, because, you know, the graveyard over there at the farm is one champion after another, and to be a small piece of a big operation, I was honored to, for them to even think about me, never mind, you know, sending me horses to train.
And Jack, you almost won two grade ones on Saturday. Lexingtonian just missed in the Bing Crosby, and he had scratched out of the race at Saratoga a week earlier. Can you just talk about the dynamics of kind of after he scratched? I know you breezed him the next day. What went into the decision to ship across the country? And secondly, would you say it hurt a little less to take that, you know, kind of tough beat after obviously having a great day at Saratoga?
You know, getting beats, obviously, tough because you want to figure out why you're getting beat and how do you better that horse to improve next time. But to get beat like that in a grade one, you but we were pleased. We would have took a good second going into it. Just rewinding back to 2 weeks before, we breezed him at Keeneland and put him on a van on that Monday, the week of the Vanderbilt to run on the Saturday. So we had him prepped, you know, in my opinion, to compete on that Saturday, not the following Saturday. We did all of his hard pieces of work 2 weeks before, and we gave him an easy piece of work before he got on the van, expecting him to run that Saturday. So I think Lexingtonian had everything going against him because he was ready to run, as I think the public saw, you know, he got a little bit wound up because naturally he was ready to run. We gave him 2 months in between his Churchill allowance win to the Vanderbilt. The reason being that is, you know, I'd look at the raggers and sheet numbers, and he leapt forward and ran an extremely fast number to where potentially if I ran him back quick, he might bounce. So we look forward to the, you know, he ships very well, Lexingtonian. So I thought, you know what, that type of raggers and number would potentially compete in a grade one, and what grade ones are around 2 months after the Churchill win. So the Vanderbilt popped up, and it was very unfortunate what happened. You know, Lexingtonian's never had any sort of gate issues before in the past, and unfortunately Whitmore broke through the gate, and Tyler explained just it took Whitmore a while to get back, and he was just ready to run, and he probably thought, wait a minute, that's unfair, Whitmore gets a 5 lengths head start, I want to go. And obviously Tyler's restraining him, and he just sat there, he did not flip in the gate, he just sat down, and I think it's a Naira rule that you're an automatic scratch. So just quickly, I call the shoes, hey, what sort of list are we on? Obviously, I want to do what the rules are, and obviously I've got to do what the shoes tell me. And he wasn't on any list. Our vet went over him immediately after, when he got back to the barn, went over him Sunday morning. We breezed him Sunday, as everyone saw. Had to ship him back to Keene then to catch a flight out to California on the Monday. So he had everything against him going into that. I had to school him in the gate at Del Mar several times just to get his mind back on, been relaxed in the gate and expecting him to compete in a grade one that Saturday after all the shift around in 2 weeks was a lot for him, but he overcame all that and ran a credible race.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your history because, you know, you're a young guy, you're an up and coming guy. It's kind of taken off for you right now, and I don't want to jinx it for you, but you're really, people know who you are, and people are taking notice that you're a guy who can train. Obviously, the Calumet connection helps you be more visible. But I wanted to know about your history in racing and kind of how that's prepared you for this moment on the center stage.
You know, I grew up with, you know, my parents at a small level. I was always, from as far as I can remember, there was racing on the TV, or we were going to some, you know, big events in the northeast of England racing wise. And I fell in love with it from day one and always wanted to have some sort of involvement in it. And fast forward, I was fortunate enough to have been offered a soccer scholarship at University of Louisville, which offered the equine program. And in return, I worked summers for Todd Pletcher. That was my first introduction to the American side of racing. And thanks to Todd, I worked for Eddie, Doug, all the guys I met along the way to allow me to learn, to put me in this position. But I grew up playing soccer, and obviously you got 10 other guys, including myself, on the team. And I cannot do this without the people behind me. And I believe you're only as good as the people behind you. And fortunately enough, it's all about the horse. If you're not provided the horse, you can't do anything. And fortunately enough, I've been provided decent horses, and I've got great staff behind me to help me out along the way.
Hey, Jack, going back to the personal lens, and one thing that we didn't mention earlier was you had to sweat out an inquiry there. And what was that like, the 5-6 minutes, and were you worried that the horse would come down?
Well, for me, the inquiry only went on for probably about a minute and 30 seconds because I had no idea there was an inquiry. I went out, I watched it here at Keeneland. And so I went outside the barn just to thank the other guys and who were watching it. And so I came back in the barn and looked up, and there was an inquiry going on. So I didn't know exactly that immediately was going on, but you know, it's a stressful time, especially the race obviously we're in. And the first time I ever spoke to Jose Lescano was after he hung up the phone to the stewards. And I just wanted to say to Jose, whether we're unfortunate enough disqualified, I want you to know we're very proud of the ride that you give Vexatious. And if unfortunately we get disqualified, we'd be very happy to finish second. And that's what I said to Jose, which we were. Thankfully, it went in our favor, but it was some anxious moments when the longer it goes on, typically it results in a disqualification. So it kept going on, and you sort of start thinking we're going to get disqualified here.
Jack, one more quick question for me, just because this always interests me. When you have a nice horse like you have, you know, with the winner, you look at I always look at the split times. And it was remarkably, remarkably consistent. You know, basically your filly ran 24-1, 24-1, 23-4, 24, and finished up in 12 and change. Does she do that in the morning? Is she just like a consistent kind of grinder where it's just every eighth of a mile is 12 seconds, 12 seconds, 12 seconds if you wanted her to? Because the reason why I ask is you've done something differently with her than the previous trainers have. Because she's run back-to-back career best numbers. So you must be doing something different. I'm wondering if it's just relaxing her now that she's six and letting her gallop a lot, or is there something else?
I think it obviously goes to Vexatious and the talent she has, but she has an extremely high cruising speed, and she can carry that over a distance of ground. And as everybody saw that, you know, she galloped out and she kept going, and she'll continue to do that on a consistent basis. And what we found with Vexatious, she is a filly that loves to train at 5:30. She goes out right when the track opens because that's what she wants. She's very businesslike and she wants to get on with it. And when I initially got her, if I ask her to go 3/4 of a mile in a workout, she will put so much effort into that 3/4 of a mile to where she may have been doing too much in the mornings and not leaving it for the afternoon. So what we decided was we'd back up all of her works to 0.5 miles, so where she's not doing too much in the mornings, and fingers crossed that will result in, you know, her being a little bit more energetic in the afternoons and being able to, like you said, carry that, you know, her high cruising speed over a distance of ground. So what we found is back in her workouts, and you'll see she won't work further than 0.5 mile. And it's slightly worrisome when you just breeze them 0.5 mile. Do they have enough foundation in them to compete at that classic type of distance on the dirt? Because it is tougher to run on the dirt than the grass. But with her, she puts so much effort into her gallops and into her 0.5 mile breezes that she's in that happy stage of her career at the moment. So that's what hopefully continues her to be successful.
And just a quick follow-up, what made you decide to go from the turf to the dirt? Because she was a legitimate grade two, grade three, competitor that looked like she needed the 1.25 miles, which they usually only run on the turf races. So that was a big decision on your part. And obviously it proved correct.
Yeah, I suppose you open yourself up to sort of a big mistake when you try something like that, because like you said, the success she'd had recently on the grass. And I think what sort of one vexatious answered that question. She trained so well on the dirt that if I never give her another chance, I think I wasn't doing what's right by the filly. And I went through all of her replays, and she has some good back class on the dirt. And it was, and I don't know, if I'm sure a lot of people might look at it now, but she ran, I watched all of her replays and tried to diagnose a form of who she ran against. She ran against the boys in one other than at Santa Anita, and this is what really pushed me to try it. And he either won the race or finished second, was Battle of Midway. And the form she held on the dirt, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I'll have to go back and watch, I think she had troubling running that day in the allowance to where, wait a minute, she ran a credible third behind Breeders' Cup Mile winner. Let's give her another shot on the dirt.
Jack, we talked a little bit about Calumet and what it's like to train for them. Would you say you spot horses any differently training for kind of a breeding operation? And obviously black type is, you know, particularly at a premium for mares, and obviously they stand stallions as well. Would you say you spot any differently or keep that in mind when you're picking races out?
Absolutely. You know, you sort of have to look at the bigger picture, and with an operation, any breeding operation, you got broodmare, you want black type. So you're trying to map out a career for a certain horse. And if you think they've got some sort of potential, you really want to capitalize when, you know, say a filly or a mare is doing well, to try and get black type. And, you know, for instance, Vexatious, that she ran a good second to Monomoy Girl in the Ruffian, and maybe it's the most logical spot, her next race, what would have been the Summer Colony. I think she would have been maybe 1-5 in there, like Midnight Pursuit would have been, was in the personal ensign. I think the Summer Colony's been run this week.
I think it's today, actually, yeah, Wednesday.
Yeah, I know it was, it was coming back relatively at the same time, but we had, Vexatious was doing phenomenally well. It was coming back in 3 weeks. So whether we ran in the Summer Colony or the personal ensign, timing-wise, it would have been the same. But because, to try and answer your question, spotting them, I do definitely take consideration because of the breeding operation and who owns the filly. Been grade one place, probably would have enhanced her pedigree more than winning a listed Summer Colony. She's already a grade three winner. But to get grade one place, so yes, spotting them would definitely, you know, pending the horses, and thankfully Calumet, their first interest is making sure each horse is, you know, sound, healthy, and been able to perform at their highest level. And if they are, we'll definitely take a shot at, you know, a grade one like we did. And thanks to Vexatious for allowing us to do that.
And I got to say, as a racing fan and analyst, we always appreciate trainers who are willing to take those chances. It leads to better racing. It leads to more interesting racing. So putting yourself out there and putting yours out there pays off, you know, it pays off for all of us. And we're glad it paid out for you, Jack Sisterson. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations and continued success, my man.
Oh, thanks a lot, guys. Tell me, it means a lot.
Sure thing, Jack.
Thanks. Congrats.
Thanks.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Jack Sisterson will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder to enter the industry-leading 2020 Keeneland November Breeding Stock Sale to be held at the home of the Breeders' Cup. Learn more at november.keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, our Green Group guest of the week, Jack Sisterson, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Nathan Wilkinson, Anthony LaRocca, and Danny Seiper, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Thank you for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.